This podcast contains explicit language.
So that happened. This week, an awful terrorist attack in Istanbul seemed to trigger less than the usual amount of Facebook sympathy. But Donald Trump still wants to torture everyone. Democratic congressional candidate Zephyr Teachout cruised to victory in the New York primary. Will the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee get her back in the general? We'll ask Zephyr Teachout herself. Congress took off on recess without doing anything significant on gun control. Have Democrats missed their window? And why doesn't anyone ever talk about the number one type of gun death? We'll ask Democratic Senator Chris Murphy. Finally, what's the deal with everyone loving Alexander Hamilton so much? Historian William Hoagland joins us to explain why Hamilton is so overrated. I'm Arthur Delaney with Huffington Post reporters Zach Carter and Jessica Schulberg. Jason Lincolns is on vacation, and here's what happened first. Welcome, everybody. This is Arthur Delaney. I'm joined by my colleague, Zach Carter.
Hi, everybody.
And Jessica Schulberg.
Hey, guys.
And we had a horrible thing happen this week, very deadly attack in Istanbul. What happened, Jessica?
Well, we had an attack at the airport in Istanbul. There's three suspects coming from Russia, Kyrgyzstan, and Uzbekistan. Nobody has claimed responsibility yet, which is unusual, but Turkish and American officials say that it resembles an ISIS attack because you had the three men were all armed with guns, and then subsequently after shooting at people, detonated themselves. Two people inside of the airport, one person in the parking lot who detonated himself as people within the airport were running outside. The current death count, I believe, is at 43 and well over 230 people wounded right now.
So this is an attack on the scale of something like Brussels
Paris,
or Paris.
Brussels, yeah.
And the people are immediately talking about who did it, and it's all about ISIS. Mm-hmm. And why is that? Like, nobody's claimed responsibility, but there's a bit of an obsession over whether it's ISIS, and it's just odd that it's such a strange, difficult thing to figure out.
Right. I was actually surprised, well, by two things. One, that you didn't see ISIS immediately claim responsibility, because we saw that even in the case of Orlando, where there's not a clear kind of command structure from ISIS to the Orlando shooter, just the fact that he was willing to lend some sort of allegiance to ISIS, they were happy to say, yes, yes, this is part of the caliphate. Look how strong we are. And they're usually very quick to claim responsibility for attacks. So if it was an ISIS-backed attacker, I'm not really sure why they haven't claimed responsibility. On a similar note, I'm surprised by how quickly the U.S. and Turkish officials have been willing to say it's ISIS. John Brennan said it very much looks like an ISIS attack. He's the head of the CIA. The Turkish prime minister also said it resembles an ISIS attack. And it definitely does look a lot like the attacks we've seen in Paris and Brussels, where you have two or three men coordinating in a highly populated area with lots of civilians, with a mixture of explosives and guns, kind of just firing indiscriminately at civilians.
But so, is it unusual that the perps are from Russia and Kyrgyzstan, or is that not something people should be focused on?
I don't find that super unusual. I mean, there has been sort of a extremist group of people in parts of Russia, and I think the whole thing we've seen over the past couple years in Turkey and Syria is just people flooding from all over the world, really, this influx of foreign fighters. And for a long time, Turkey really wasn't doing enough to sort of secure its borders and prevent foreign fighters from coming in. I think the latest we have is an unnamed Turkish official told CNN that these three individuals came into Turkey about a month ago from the ISIS stronghold in Syria called Raqqa. That hasn't yet been confirmed, but it wouldn't be surprising if somebody who wasn't necessarily Syrian or Iraqi came in.
So one of the things that fascinates me about this particular attack is that you remember after Paris, like how the entire United States, most of the what we call the Western world, just had this big outpouring of grief on social media, on cable news. It's not like people are ignoring this attack, but you haven't had the same level of sympathy. And if
people aren't putting Turkish flags on their Facebook profile.
Right.
HuffPost put something on their Instagram.
Yeah.
And except for that.
But if you've ever been to Istanbul, I mean, You name one city in the world that is a better city than Istanbul. That is just one of the greatest places in the world. Thousands of years of history from all sorts of different cultures. It's just a wonderful, wonderful place. And what's been happening in that city over the past 2 years is just an absolutely unspeakable tragedy. This used to be, a totally safe, wonderful, cosmopolitan place in Turkey, and now it's become the subject of a series of attacks. This is not the first. I guess I'm curious what you guys think about that lack of empathy, and then also what's going on in Turkish politics that has made Istanbul a target. It's not like it just became. It's not like the border with Syria just sort of opened up, last week or something.
Right. Well, several things on the issue of empathy. I do unfortunately think that you've been to Istanbul, you've seen how beautiful it is, and a lot of people have. It's a major international hub that a lot of airlines stop over through, and a lot of people have been there. But I think it's still hard for most Western audiences to kind of relate on a personal level to Istanbul in the way that they would Paris or even Brussels, which isn't too exciting of a place to be. It's just Western Europe, feels more familiar, feels more similar to us. It's a huge hypocrisy. It's incredible. On the issue of Turkey's borders, that's twofold. On the one hand, yes, being on the border of Syria is going to make you a target and is going to cause some spillover. You can't be neighboring as to a country that's engrossed in this horrible civil war, not reap some of the outfall. At the same time, Erdogan, Turkey's leader, was very, very kind of playing a double game in the early years of the civil war, because as the war in Syria heated up, Syria's Kurdish people developed sort of an independent enclave in Syria, which sort of made Erdogan concerned that the Kurds would do something similar in Turkey. So for a while, he didn't do much to sort of stop the flow of foreign fighters in and out of Syria through Turkey's borders, because he sort of viewed it as a bulwark against the Kurds gaining autonomy. And at the same time, he would be happy to see Assad step down. So I think there was some reluctance in the beginning to secure the border in the way that we now realize he should have done. In the past several months, he's definitely ramped up efforts to close off the border, allowed the U.S. to use an airbase to launch drone strikes and airstrikes. So it's just a little bit.
But for a long time, Erdogan was sort of a right wing candidate in Turkish politics. Essentially, Turkish politics are somewhat similar to American politics, right, in that the cosmopolitan centers like Istanbul tend to be sort of more liberal. More open minded about social issues, things like that. And then in the countryside, things are more conservative. And Erdogan definitely was elected with a more conservative countryside type of vote. But for a long time, he was sort of engaged in a sort of tacit alliance with ISIS, in which he was more concerned about the threat of Kurdish nationalism and Kurdish separatism than he seemed to be about ISIS.
I'd say an alliance with ISIS is overstating it. I think, in my opinion, a fairer description would be a tacit alliance with maybe some more of the extremist-minded opposition groups fighting Assad. And then, there's some blurred lines between those groups and ISIS, especially when you get into al-Nusra, which is part of al-Qaeda.
Sure.
There is a lot of bleeding between the groups. I don't think he was ever quite foolish enough to not recognize the threat posed by ISIS. And I think
claims, but it didn't seem to be as much of a priority.
Kurds were definitely more of a priority, because the fight against the Kurds is within his country. That's his own civil war. That's his first priority. What's going on in Syria with ISIS? Terrible. But if they're fighting Assad, they're fighting the Kurds. This isn't the end of the world.
Jessica, what did you make of the political reaction here with Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump?
Quite predictable. I think Trump patted himself on the back again, just like he did. Just after Orlando, the shows that I'm right. Terrorism's bad. We need to keep terrorists out of the country. Like, no Syrian refugees, even though Syrian refugees had nothing to do with this attack or Orlando. He recently pointed to this attack as evidence that we should do some more waterboarding. Again, it's unclear what the connection is there, but that's his response. Hillary Clinton's response, also pretty predictable, just a broad statement that the U.S. can't afford to withdraw from the world and from this fight, which is clearly directed at Donald Trump's sort of isolationist attitude. But it would be interesting to see if she gets elected, if we see a no-fly zone or kind of a ramping up of military engagement in Syria.
All right, but so far it looks like this is not something that's exactly scrambling our politics at all.
I think our politics, You mean our policy in Syria or?
No, just the political debate, the foreign policy.
I think
in Washington.
It's allowed each side to sort of double down on what they've been saying.
I think it's kind of interesting that Hillary Clinton is like the sane person to liberals and sort of the left in this conversation, even though she's clearly sending signals that she would be more hawkish in terms of military intervention than Donald Trump would be.
I think liberals are sort of left without a candidate right now. I mean, we either have someone who says, well, you know, let's just bomb terrorist families and waterboard the shit out of everyone, or someone who says, yes, we should respect human rights, but we're probably also going to have to bomb them, but maybe in a more discriminate way than Donald Trump is talking about.
Yes, well, drones.
It's not even clear to me that Trump – I mean, it's like his economic policy. It's not clear that there's a policy
right,
there.
Right. It's sort of whatever he feels in the moment.
Sometimes he sounds like he's an anti-war guy who doesn't want to do all these interventions, and other times he's like
– we should bomb them very hard.
Yes.
Donald Trump in his supple mind. All right. We're going to leave it there. We'll be right back.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
We're back. This is Arthur Delaney, and I'm joined by Senator Chris Murphy, a Democrat from Connecticut, who last month spent all night talking on the Senate floor in favor of new gun control legislation. Senator, thanks for joining me.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So, Senator, after your talking filibuster, House Democrats staged a sit-in on the floor of the House, two huge spectacles, one after another. But the Democrats in the House didn't get the vote they were asking for. Senate Democrats didn't win a vote on gun control legislation. Are you optimistic about gun control right now?
Well, I'm not optimistic about gun control right now. We clearly don't have the votes in either the House or the Senate to pass meaningful anti-gun violence legislation. But I do think that, you know, when you get 5 or 10 years from now, I think you're going to look back on the last few weeks as a watershed moment in the history of the anti-gun violence movement. I think this was the week in which Democrats became completely confident of their ability to use this issue as a means to win votes amongst the swing electorate in elections. It was a week in which more Republicans than ever before crossed the NRA and voted with us to support common sense gun violence measures. And it was a week or 2 weeks in which the American public really, you know, joined this effort in a meaningful way. I mean, I think we are just much more powerful as a political organization now than we have been before. So I think this is a week that will lead to victories down the road. But, you know, listen, the NRA spent decades building up the political power that's allowed them to, you know, effectively hold control of Congress. But we are 4 years into the modern anti-gun violence movement, and I think that we are on our way to ultimately winning these votes. I mean, I don't know how you can't if you have 80 to 90% of the American public on your side. We'll get there.
So, Senator Murphy, your talking filibuster was spurred in part by the mass shooting in Orlando, which were, you know, there was a terrorist sympathizer, and a lot of what we talked about was the threat of terrorists getting guns. But is that really the problem? Because, you know, terrorism is a tiny fraction of gun violence.
Well, there's a multitude of problems, right? And I think we always get caught in a trap, or people want to catch us in a trap by saying, well, you're focusing on this issue, but it doesn't solve this other issue, right? So there are a lot of things we need to focus on. We need to acknowledge that right now, groups like Al-Qaeda and ISIS are calling upon their potential lone wolf attackers not to requisition control of airplanes, but to walk into gun shows and buy assault weapons. The assault weapon is the new weapon of choice for potential terrorists in this country, and so we should legislate to prevent that trend line from continuing. But yes, that doesn't have a lot to do with the fact that 80 people die every day from guns because of our very loose and lax gun laws, whether it be on background checks or gun trafficking or permit to carry. So we also have to address that set of laws as well. But, you know, we can't get caught in a trap in which we can only legislate based on the last shooting. We can't get caught in a trap in which we allow the perfect to be the enemy of the good. Yes, in the wake of Orlando, we were talking about the fact that tougher laws with respect to people on the terrorist watch list can prevent mass shootings. But, you know, that's just the tip of the iceberg when it comes to trying to solve this problem.
Senator Chris Murphy, most gun deaths are suicide. Is it not possible to talk about suicide in politics? Because you almost never hear about it.
Well, I mean, I talk about it all the time in that I spend a lot of my time trying to promote a major rewrite of our mental health laws. And I also talk about the statistics, which tell you that proximity to a firearm is one of the most important factors involved in suicide deaths. The fact of the matter is that most people don't make up their minds to take their life until very shortly before that moment. And when they have easy access to a firearm, they often make good on that suicidal thought. When they can't find a firearm readily, that moment often passes. So I certainly, you know, talk about this, and I'm never shy to mention the fact that 2/3 of those 80 deaths a day are suicides. Not all of it is about access to guns. Some of it is our very broken mental health system. But there's a reason why our level of suicide is epidemically worse than most other nations, and that's in part because of the easy access that people have to guns when those thoughts run through their head.
Senator Chris Murphy, 33,000 people died from gun injuries in 2013, and 2/3 of those were suicide. I'm sure you're familiar. But does that get left out? I mean, people just talk about gun violence and take the big number that obscures the fact that, you know, most of this is actually suicide. Does it get left out just because people are afraid of being shot by someone else, and there's no, you know, people don't think about the chance that suicide will affect them?
So I think you hit the nail on the head. I think the focus largely is on gun murders and mass shootings, because those are you know, those are things that you can't control. If someone has the ability to shoot you, you might be more concerned about it than you might be about the intersection of guns and suicide, because you would suspect you have more control over that. You know, as we know, you lose control over your mind pretty quickly when you catapult into a deep depression or you have a psychotic break. And so, you know, it's probably a real false sense of security that people have that they wouldn't be a victim of suicide, because there are lots of people who committed suicide who a year or 2 years beforehand would have never thought of themselves as the kind of person who would get into that kind of state of mind. So, you know, it clearly is something we have to talk more about. But you are right that most people are talking about the mass shootings, about the gun violence that happens in our cities, because they think that that's much more of a threat to them than being involved in a suicide.
Now, so leaving mental health aside, even though, you know, I think in all instances of suicide, it's a factor. If you talked about to talk about guns and suicide, you would have to talk about straight up limiting access to guns rather than what could be considered side issues like terrorism and assault rifles. Is that something that's like politically not feasible? Like, look, we've got to just take people's guns away in some situations, or make it harder to get all types of guns, including handguns?
Well, there is a Second Amendment right under the Heller decision to private firearm ownership, and that is the law of the land, and none of the policy measures that we're contemplating would change or reverse that. So you are not going to eliminate the threat of suicide by taking guns out of the hands of law-abiding citizens. But the fact of the matter is that there are lots of legal and illegal weapons that are in circulation today, and that sheer volume often makes the threat of suicide much much more real.
What about, more broadly on just gun control in general, what about things like license requirements or gun insurance, these sort of meatier, I guess you could say, ideas for restricting firearm access?
Well, in Connecticut, we passed now 2 years ago a permit to carry law that requires people to get a permit from local law enforcement in order to carry a weapon, which, you know, allows local law enforcement to, you know, often go above and beyond the background check to these local law enforcement officials who, you know, have a much sort of greater beat on the kind of people who shouldn't own weapons, have been able to keep them out of the hands of potential criminals in a way that has allowed Connecticut's gun violence rate to drop by 40% since we passed that law. So, you know, there are measures that you can pass relative to permitting that have already shown pretty significant results in places like my state.
Okay, lastly, Senator Chris Murphy, what's happening next in the Senate? I know there was a sort of test vote on a compromise measure backed by Susan Collins. Do you think Majority Leader Mitch McConnell is going to bring that up, or will you be doing something else in the near future?
Well, we've already moved on from that bill, so the Majority Leader's already taken that bill that the Collins Amendment was pending to off the floor. I think we are probably at a stuck moment here in the Senate. We got more votes on the Collins Amendment than we ever have before for anti-gun violence measures. More Republicans broke with the NRA than ever before. That's good news. But we've got to take this issue to the electorate now. And a lot of my focus is going to be on, between now and November, building a political operation, a political machinery throughout the country that deselects members of Congress who voted against 90% of their constituents. We're going to eventually have to show that there are some political consequences to voting with the NRA and against the vast majority of the people you represent. And so I think this is a moment in which I'd love to get more votes in the Senate, but it probably is, there's probably greater utility in focusing our efforts on the fall right now.
Senator Chris Murphy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Arthur.
And we'll be right back.
And we're back. I'm Zach Carter, joined by, as usual,
Arthur Delaney.
And we have a very special guest today, a historian whose books include The Whiskey Rebellion, Declaration, and Founding Finance, William Hoagland. Bill, thanks for joining us.
Great to be here.
So there has been a mania, a fever, a collective public enthusiasm for the life of Alexander Hamilton over the past couple of years. Mostly tied, I think, to the popularity of the Hamilton musical. But you have done quite a bit of work on Hamilton's legacy and career. And it doesn't really square with the public perception that seems to be out there right now. What do you think people are missing with the current sort of historical fervor?
Well, yeah, it's funny because the musical, of course, is like, it's what everyone really is talking about right now. But it's kind of the icing on the cake, kind of from where I'm sitting, in terms of the grand progress of the Hamilton industry, which is what I kind of think of it as. Hamiltonians everywhere across the political spectrum, you know.
Big Hamilton.
Right. Yeah, everyone. I mean, so that the musical came along and just kind of like really blew it up. But it's funny because I've been writing about this for like almost, I mean, like 13 years maybe, or something like that, 12 years that I've been sort of looking at this. And you know, the musical sort of sits on top of an entire apparatus that really, it's the big biography by Ron Chernow, and then just the kind of adoration of how, the invocation really of Hamilton's name by people from, you know, Hank Paulson to Hillary Clinton to David Brooks. You know, I mean, it's just been going on for quite some time. And now we have this real craze that comes with this kind of stunning, you know, theatrical event. Now, you know, I guess what you asked is, like, what's everyone missing? I mean, it just seems to me that it's, you know, invoking Hamilton from a finance point of view, it's very interesting, but like what doesn't get discussed are the kinds of things that Hamilton did as in action to bring about his plan of national finance, without which, you know, we probably wouldn't have really created a nation. You know, he is crucially important, of course, but some of that story is a lot darker than I think people who invoke his legacy really want to know.
Yeah, it's very interesting to watch him sort of be held up as a progressive icon. People like, you know, Lin-Manuel Miranda, who is the author of the musical, the screenwriter and everything, or stage writer. I'm not sure what the word is there for theater. You know, he's this very, you know, impassioned sort of liberal advocate for instance, debt relief to Puerto Rico. And yet Hamilton's, you know, financial platform, if you go through when I went through your book, The Whiskey Rebellion, just didn't seem to really square with that sort of debtor focused rehabilitation kind of policy. I mean, what should people know about Hamilton that doesn't seem to be getting out there in the discourse right now?
Well, yeah, I mean, first of all, it's not just in my book, The Whiskey Rebellion, although I did kind of assertively bring these things out in that book. But of course, if it were just me who thought, you know, if I thought I was the only person who ever came up with this, I'd be more eccentric even than maybe I already am. So, you know, there's a whole body of scholarship that just hasn't really been put front and center that I had to rely on when writing The Whiskey Rebellion. I relied on a lot of primary sources and read Hamilton himself very closely. And I mean, just generally speaking, no, you're just not going to get from Hamilton anything about debt relief. You're going to get from Hamilton the shoring up of the creditor class, and he had very cogent reasons for that. That's the funny thing. It's not like, oh, he was secretly, you know, maniacally sort of pretending to be a Democrat and a Democratic person, you know, with a small D on the one hand, and then on the other hand, he was secretly, you know, shoring up concentrations of wealth. He believed, for very cogent reasons, that shoring up concentrations of wealth was the key to nationhood. And in a certain sense, I think you could say he's right. It just should give us maybe raise some new questions about what we think nationhood is and what we think concentration of wealth does. But, you know, income equality or, you know, debt relief, these were the opposite of his agendas. So then it becomes funny when people, especially on the left, invoke his legacy. I think one reason they do, though, is that he was very much an activist government guy. So from a liberal point of view, you can say, well, look, this is the basis of, you know, you could even say it's the basis of kind of a New Deal approach to using government power to set and enforce finance policy, monetary policy for certain social ends.
Tell us about the Newburgh crisis. This is give us the poop on Hamilton straight.
Yeah, so the Newburgh crisis, and this is a funny thing. Like, people who are really into Hamilton right now, and yet you say the Newburgh crisis, and it's not going to figure, really, for them. Although, I mean, from my point of view, and I'm not totally alone in this, this is the series of events that formed him as a public person and as an actor, an activist public person, without whom, you know, maybe nationhood would not have occurred. In other words, it formed him in a place where I think his emotional life was most intensely lived. So it's funny that we don't know much about it, and I think one reason we don't know much about it is that it's not edifying in any way by most readers' standards, or even by the standards of the people who invoke him.
Well, give us some very basics. What happened? What did he do? Was this a coup?
I'm ranting on about it without saying what it is, and no one knows what it is. This is a funny thing. This is a position I'm always in, so I apologize for that. Basically, it was an attempt to threaten during 1782 and 1783, with peace in the offing in the Revolutionary War. There was an element within Congress and in the military, the revolutionary officer class, who decided it would be a wise idea to threaten the Continental Congress with a threat of military coup. I'm emphasizing threaten because I don't think it's provable that Hamilton and his cohort actually wanted to carry out a military coup and take over the country that way, but they certainly did think they could get leverage for their finance plans by threatening that.
And that's just not very democratic.
No, it was totally anti-democratic. And you know, Hamilton and his crowd were not alone at that time in being undemocratic or anti-democratic, we should note. Most of the founding fathers, the famous founders, were extremely dubious about what they called democracy, and they wanted to keep power and political power in the hands of those with financial power. He wasn't alone in that, but this was an extreme effort in which the idea would be to bring the officer class into the creditor, public creditor class, give officers federal bonds, Congress's bonds, as a form of back pay, and thus add to the creditor, public creditor lobby, like the most powerful kind of lobby there is on earth, an armed military force. Like, what if they just refused to lay down their arms? That was the attempt. There's a name that comes up that, again, if I start rattling on about him, people will say, who is this? Funny, because Hamilton's main mentor, his most important mentor and person who really taught him a lot about finance, is a guy named Robert Morris, who was really at the head of this this crisis, this founding era crisis in which we might have actually opened up the possibility of military coup. This guy, Robert Morris, is not someone who comes up much in the public understanding of Hamilton. And yet for Hamilton, if you really care about where Hamilton was coming from, Robert Morris is a critically important character. He was the financier of the revolution, and it was largely his idea to try to pull off this threat, at least, of military coup in 1782 and 1783. Hamilton comes onto the public stage, so the fact that we don't know that about him takes something away from his very development.
So William Hoagland, Robert Morris, and Alexander Hamilton, as the Revolutionary War was winding down, threatened a coup, and the aim of this was to establish an authoritarian government that made rich people richer.
Yes. Now, should I qualify that statement? Should I just say yes, or should I...
Yes is fine.
Well, I mean, look, there is this idea in your book, right?
Correct. That is correct. That is correct.
That's bad.
A little bluntly put, but there you go. We need bluntness around Hamilton because there hasn't been enough.
And that's another argument of yours, that you need some bluntness here.
Yeah, that's definitely true. I mean, you make these statements, people go, well, there's no balance to that statement. I'm like, well, no, there's no balance to the other statements that leave these things out. So is some of my effort, a little bit corrective and therefore, louder and more blunt and more simplistic than it needs to be? No, it's not, because all of the things I'm saying are critically important elements of Hamiltonian finance and of Hamilton's own life as he lived it as a public figure. And so it's just as distortive to leave them out. But somehow when you bring these things up and really bring them to life and show Hamilton in action, it's just very easy for people to go, well, that's just overstated.
That's kind of Zen-like.
Right. Well, and when you talk about things like the creditor class and the officer class, I mean, creditors are the people who have the money that they are lending to other people, so they are rich to begin with. Officers are distinguished from rank-and-file soldiers by virtue of being officers. You're talking about an alliance between the wealthiest people in society against the people who do not have access to that money. And that's the type of system that Hamilton was trying to go for. And I think you do a really good job illustrating that in your book, which everybody should read. It's called The Whiskey Rebellion by William Hoagland. And, Bill, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate it.
And we'll be right back. And we're back. We are joined. I'm Zach Carter, here with Arthur Delaney.
Hi.
And we are joined by a frequent guest of the show, Zephyr Teachout, who has some news. Zephyr, anything interesting happened to you this week?
Oh, yes. I just won the Democratic primary.
Oh!
I ran for Congress in New York's 19th district, and we had a huge win. It was really, really exciting.
But we have a winner on our show.
We're the opposite of candidate confessional. No losers allowed.
And you know, if you're not, if you're, one of the things that was really exciting to us was voter turnout is low. It's always low. It's way too low. I wish it was a lot higher, but it was significantly higher than it was 4 years ago. And also, it was significantly higher than the Republican turnout on the Republican side. So it's exciting to see that we have a more energized base.
Now you defeated your closest opponent was a Ivy League educated gay organic farmer. Sounds like sort of a cartoon character from Democratic hippie land. Do you feel guilty about just beating the tar out of this gay hippie farmer?
You know, I want to say I had a great, I have a lot of respect for Will. Yeah, so Will, I think he spent about $400,000, and he ran a very serious campaign. It was a campaign about issues, and I'm completely committed to the small D democracy, lots of events, so we had not just three debates, but dozens of forums. I think we appeared together 15 or 16 times where people got to ask us questions, and I have to give Will a lot of credit because it never became negative. It really, and a lot of the time, it wasn't even a sort of he said, she said, this and that disagreement. It's just a different emphasis, a different approach towards how to get things done. And I thought it was really good for people to get a chance to come out and ask questions about, you know, how do we do something about climate change? How do we do something about money in politics? We did have a difference of opinion. He does not support publicly financed elections.
Zephyr Teachout, tell us about how you will now be pivoting from the Democratic primary to the general election against Republican John Faso.
I'm running on the exact same thing I've been running on the last 5 months, and also that I ran on in 2014 in the gubernatorial race. We have a real serious problem of corruption. A lot of it is legal, even more legal after the Supreme Court opinion the other day. And gridlocked, it's not functioning. We got to make Congress work again. We got to change some of these basic systems. And I'm talking about clean water and protecting our water. I'm talking about stopping TPP and renegotiating NAFTA. Talking about education policy. I think that sometimes people sort of think of these as Republican or Democratic issues, but I gotta say, clean water is not a partisan issue, or certainly shouldn't be. So there's no pivot. I am who I am.
Now, you are generally affiliated with the progressive wing of the party. I believe in our piece on your victory, we referred to you as a progressive icon. People associate you with Elizabeth Warren. Bernie Sanders helped raise money for your campaign. In a district that is was previously held by a Republican, how do you tailor a progressive message to that sort of community?
Again, just to be clear, there's not a lot of tailoring going on. The issues are pretty much the same. And the Republican who's stepping down is a guy named Chris Gibson, who, you know, obviously we disagree on some basic stuff, but I will say I have a lot of respect for him and have a good relationship with. What I hear from everybody is they want Congress to work. Function. Actually function. You know, we can't even
good
be
luck.
Talking about who's 2 inches to the left or 2 inches to the right on this or that issue if people aren't even talking to each other. And I hear people just saying, we've got to get this moving again. So one of the reasons that we have a lot of excitement, and I heard from some of my Republican independent friends saying, I'm sorry I couldn't vote for you in this Democratic primary, is people believe I'm going to go try to shake things up, and I'm not going to be afraid, and I'm going to try to actually get at the basic machinery problem, which is Congress has some structural problems, mostly the way it's funded, mostly the way campaigns are funded. But because of that structural problem, Congress has fundamentally turned into a closed room where people help each other out and aren't serving their constituents.
Zephyr Teachout. A lot of people have said, Donald Trump being on the top of the Republican ticket will be very helpful to Democrats down ballot. But it sounds like are you going to talk about Donald Trump in your campaign, or will you stick to these progressive priorities?
What I hear about is that people are really looking for a representative who, I come from the Democratic Party. I'm proud of that. But who is going to come with an independent approach. And the fact that I ran against Andrew Cuomo a couple of years ago, that sort of a showing that I'm willing to be independent seems really important, not just to Democrats, but to Republicans and independents. Because they're kind of sick of the way people usually talk about politics, and they're not necessarily that happy about what's happening nationally.
Well, what's going on with you and the Democratic Party itself? Because you've had a runaway polling lead in this race. You I believe, raised more money in the first quarter of this year than any other candidate in New York from either party, mostly from small donors. That's the sort of thing that you expect the official Democratic Party apparatus to get very excited about. And yet the DCCC, their recruitment arm for the House, did not endorse you. What's going on there?
You know, I have been so focused on a few different things. One is just being everywhere in the district, talking to everyone. And we put about 18,000 miles on my car. So it's been through two oil changes since the beginning of the campaign.
But this is an expensive district. I mean, you're probably going to need some help from the party at some point on fundraising. Do you expect that to materialize?
I would appreciate it, and I also feel like it's been important for me to start with my own grassroots base. So we have over 40,000 donors. In fact, today is our last filing deadline, the last day of the filing deadline. And my real dream is to build such a massive low-dollar fundraising base. My real dream is to have public financing elections. But in this world that we're in, to build such a massive low-dollar fundraising base that I can be truly free at all times to be listening and representative and working towards, you know, the real problems that are facing people, not spending time raising money or even sort of thinking about relationships in money terms. I don't think that's the way that people want us to be thinking about relationships.
All right. Well, Zephyr Teachout, thanks so much for joining us, and congratulations on your primary victory.
Thank you. It sure feels good to win a primary.
I'll bet it does. It's second time's the charm, I guess, right?
Yes. Thank you guys for having me on.
And we'll be right back.
So that's what happened this week. This podcast was produced, edited, and engineered by Christine Canetta. Our executive producer is Nick Offenberg. I'm Arthur Delaney, and this week we were joined by Senator Chris Murphy, Democratic congressional candidate Zephyr Teachout, historian William Hoagland, and Huffington Post reporter Zach Carter and Jessica Schulberg. So That Happened is available on iTunes at itunes.com/sothathappened. Check out the whole family of Huffington Post podcasts in the iTunes store, and while you're there, subscribe and tell your friends. If there's something you'd like to hear us talk about, send an email to sothathappened@huffingtonpost.com. Thanks to all of you for listening. We miss you already.